Right now on the Daily Debrief, accusations of jury tampering in the death penalty case of a Florida man who took the stand and admitted to murder. Plus... Tearful testimony from the mother of a murdered 12-year-old girl. Does DNA tell the whole story? And a Massachusetts teen convicted of encouraging her boyfriend's suicide wants yet another appeal. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Tuesday, July 9th.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. Bob Hilla, Linda Kenny-Bodden along with me tonight. We have more bombshells today in the penalty phase of a case against a convicted Florida murderer who blames everyone else for the crime he admitted to committing. Scott Nelson demanded the chance to get on the witness stand yet again. He already admitted to killing victim Jennifer Fulford during the first phase of this case because he said he needed money. We now continue our review of the defendant's testimony, where he complained about his time in prison by saying fire sprinklers would be set off, leaving him drenched for hours and more.
There's no fans, there's no air conditioning, and there's no heat. It's Kansas. It's very, very hot in the summertime there and very, very cold in the winter. And in the unit, there's pigeons, hundreds of pigeons flying around the unit. Of course, there's feces all over the windows. Cockroaches everywhere, rats, I mean the size of hamsters. The cops brutalized the inmates on the regular. I was up on the fifth tier, so there's no windows, there's nothing. It's 120 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer. And the treatment that you receive is brutal.
When you were in segregation, were there times where you were in the unit entirely alone?
Yes.
Were there times when you had one cellmate?
Yes.
Were there times when you had two cellmates?
Yes.
So there were times when there was a total of three people within the confines of what we saw in that diagram. Is that right?
Absolutely, for months at a time.
When you were in the segregated housing units at any of the various facilities you were at, did you ever witness a murder?
Several, yes.
And did those happen? Well, when you say several, can you give us a number? Is it one or two or?
Three. I've witnessed three murders in years I've been incarcerated.
Okay, on cross-examination, Nelson rehashed the same complaints we heard the first time he was on the stand. Nelson was behind bars when back before he killed Jennifer Fulford, and he blames his probation officer for her death.
And everything was in harmony. Everything was peaceful until Mr. Dominguez, the federal employee, shows up and says, walks up to the owner and he says, I need to talk to him alone. And the next day, he came down.
I'm sorry, wait a minute. Mr. Dominguez shows up and says, I need to talk to him alone. Who is he wanting to talk to alone?
The owner.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't quite clear about the pronoun there. So go ahead, sir.
So he comes in and he deliberately, premeditatedly, and maliciously, he comes and blows me up in front of the owner. He has a gun, he's leaning on his gun, hands him a card. I mean, this is a pseudo-Christian, quasi-Christian guy, supposed to be a Christian owner, painter, owner of this business. And here's this federal guy, federal martyr, all this stuff, and she's giving him a little golden boss card, leaning on his gun, saying, what are you, crazy? What are you, nuts for letting this guy live here? Do you know this? Down a whole laundry list of crimes, and hey, this, that. Dude, I was done. I just went from, they were actually setting another business up for me to manage. I was going to get my license back, and I mean, things were going up. I was going from homeless to now, done. I'm done.
We're going to get into more about that in just a second. Remember, folks, this guy admitted to the crime. He admitted to killing the woman he's on trial for killing. Next, there was a fight about questions. Nelson says his attorneys were afraid to ask him.
Yeah, they're giving me reasons as to why I shouldn't go up there and ask, answer those questions. But I mean, it's due process. I want to go up there and answer them. They're important to me. I mean, it's the crux of the entire trial. I mean, that is those two questions, sir, is Your Honor, is the bottom line of what happened to everything in this trial and what I am and what this is. Without asking that, it's like, you know. It's silly.
So your attorneys are giving you advice that they don't want to ask you these questions. They don't think it's in your best interest.
Right.
you want to disregard their advice and have them ask you the questions anyway.
I've been thinking about this for over a year. I mean, I'm very determined in answering those two questions, sir, but regardless of what anybody, the state or the defense or anyone thinks, of course, I'm going to be the court decorum and be respectful and everything. I just want the answer, this is important to me. This is why I'm here. This is the only reason I wanted to testify. Otherwise, I wouldn't have testified at all. I've been waiting for someone to ask me these questions. And no one wants to go near these two landmines.
So the judge let the defendant remain on the stand for more direct questioning from his own defense lawyers. Some of the questions had to do with a deal the defendant claims he reached with prison officials during his first incarceration. After getting the office of Senator Bernie Sanders involved with the prison system, that's what he claims. Then there are these questions that the defense apparently did not want to ask.
Did Warden D.L. Young offer you an agreement in regards to your colostomy contradicting what he laid out to Senator Sanders?
That's exactly what he did. I was supposed to get the reversal colostomy and a halfway house. I'd been homeless before his testimony's been heard, and that doesn't work out too well for me. So they offered me a deal. They said, listen, Nelson, if you want that reversal, that colostomy operation that's gonna cost us $30,000, if you want that, we're gonna hold you here on a medical hold way past your release date, and you're not gonna get a halfway house. You're going to be homeless. We're going to send you to Orlando, Florida, and drop you off on the street corner, and toodles to you.
The second question you wanted the attorneys to ask you was, how has being treated the way that you were treated in the Federal Bureau of Prisons affected you?
In the Federal Bureau of Prisons, after 25 years in prison, you go through such extreme situations in every shape, manner, or form. I mean, you're locked in cells with extreme temperatures of cold and heat, insects, bugs, pigeons, rats, roaches. I've had cellmates, the guy who blew up the World Trade Tower, the South Tower in February of 93, the LA Yad. I've had guys that have chopped up.
Your Honor, I'm gonna object to non-responsive.
Okay.
Same objection.
Finally, the defendant delivered this statement, which left a lot of people's jaws on a lot of tables.
If the jury sends me...
And I'm going to object to non-responsive.
I'm trying to respond.
I'm going to overrule the objection at this point.
If the jury is to send me to prison with life with no parole...
Your Honor, again, I'm going to object to non-responsive.
I'll sustain the objection.
How has your mental health been affected by your previous incarceration?
I am a homicidal maniac.
Mr. Nelson, do you want to be sentenced to death?
Yes.
I'm going to object. That's an improper question.
I'll sustain the objection.
Well, for days we heard Nelson complain that his probation officer led him to lose his job and his housing. His former employer finally took the stand and said that was not the case.
Did his probation officer come and tell you what his criminal history was?
No.
Was his probation officer there to confirm that he had employment?
Yes.
After you had the conversation with the probation officer, did you fire Mr. Nelson?
No, ma'am.
Did it cause you any, based on whatever the probation officer told you about Mr. Nelson's criminal history, did it cause you any concern about continuing to employ Mr. Nelson? All right. And did the probation officer demand that you fire him?
No.
Did the probation officer demand that you kick him out of the place where he was living?
No.
Did you, in fact, fire Mr. Nelson because the probation officer came and talked to you?
No.
Why did he stop working for you?
Because we told him that when he got his check, he was supposed to leave, and he never did.
Okay.
So we dismissed him from that housing.
He got a paycheck from you.
Yeah.
And you told him he had to leave from living inside the thing, right?
Yeah, he came to me and said, I'm looking, I got this room and blah, 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 but he never left.
That's the other side of the story. Here tonight are attorneys Linda Kenney-Bodden and Bob Hillis. So, look, let's talk about this juror issue here. Apparently, a couple of jurors reported that someone in the hallway told them to let this defendant fry, maybe even punched a window, bloodied fingers here as part of this. So, Bob, is this jury tampering? What is this?
Well, basically, in the beginning of the case, they get a cautionary instruction, and then in this case, they probably got a curative instruction and were discharged. There are going to be all sorts of things in a case like this that are extraneous, but it's not witness tampering because it wasn't any of the parties trying to influence the jury. You had a member of the public that just went nuts, and basically they had to recognize that that has nothing to do with the case.
Okay, so your opinion is no jury tampering here. Linda, rats the size of hamsters. I mean, this guy is just going off about stuff. I got to ask about the ethics of this here. Why might the defense not have wanted to ask him some of these questions that he complained about, saying, my attorneys aren't asking me the questions I want them to ask?
Well, two reasons. One, they know the answer that he's going to give is untrue because he's manipulative, a homicidal maniac. Or two, they didn't think it was going to help him because he would get on the stand and say, I'm a homicidal maniac. Either way, you know, everyone should be happy who's touched him that they're not dead.
Okay, so look, I mean, the bottom line here, Bob, the ethics rules are that if your client's going to get up on the stand, in some states you have to withdraw from the whole representation if that client's going to lie. In other states, you can't ask questions. You just have to let the defendant ramble because the attorney is not supposed to have unclean hands. In other words, can't touch dishonesty from the witness stand. I'm wondering if that's what was going on behind the scenes here.
This is a defense attorney's nightmare, a client like this. Fortunately for the defense attorney, the client has taken charge, so you're not going to get into that ethics quagmire here. This guy wants to be on stage, he wants to air his grievances, and for his final act, he wants to have death and the death penalty administered to him.
And Linda, you know, I was taught by a judge years ago that sometimes you just have to let the defendants say their thing because that avoids appeal issues down the road. It's just bumpy to watch.
Especially a death penalty case. Especially this guy who now we all have a finger on his pulse.
Exactly. We'll be back to the panel in just a moment. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, an update in the case of a young Massachusetts woman convicted for coaxing her boyfriend into committing suicide. Also, the case of a Tennessee man accused of murdering a 12-year-old girl. The emotional testimony from the victim's mother when we return. Reaction to the arrest of accused billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein is coming from unlikely places. Federal prosecutors with the Southern District of New York charged Epstein yesterday with sex trafficking, and they say he had child pornography in a home they raided. Epstein had been accused in Florida, but reached a sweetheart deal involving former federal prosecutor Alex Acosta, who is now the Secretary of Labor. The deal only resulted in a minor sentence in a county jail back then. Acosta today tweeted that Epstein's crimes were, quote, horrific, and said, now that new evidence and additional testimony is available, the New York prosecution offers an important opportunity to more fully bring him to justice. Acosta issued those tweets amid calls for his own resignation because of his handling of the original Florida case. And meanwhile, the young Massachusetts woman convicted for encouraging her boyfriend to commit suicide is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take her case. Michelle Carter has long argued that the First Amendment protected her speech, which a judge and several appeals courts agreed pushed her boyfriend over the limit and spurred his suicide. Carter has lost her other appeals, and it's unlikely that the Supreme Court will take the case. Now to the case against a Tennessee man accused of murdering a 12-year-old girl. Roy Coons Jr. is accused of killing 12-year-old Joanna Ortega by beating and strangling her. Ortega was home from school because of a roller skating injury. She texted her mother that someone was knocking on her door at 4:15 p.m., whom she thought was the person who cut the family's grass. Her mother found her dead 2.5 hours later. The prosecution says the window of the victim's room had been pried open and that the defendant's DNA was on the window frame. Plus, the defendant's behavior, the state says, was suspicious.
So while he's down there hiding out in the homeless camp, his neighbor in the tent next to him is an individual you'll meet by the name of Moses. Moses O'Connor. And they will come in here and they will tell you about their encounters with Mr. Coons. They'll tell you about some statements that he made to them. Questions such as, do you think God would forgive someone for killing someone? And then trying to convince them to leave with him and go to California, that he planned to do that as soon as he got his check. He was going to be gone, wanted them to leave with him. And then the very eerie conversation where Roy Coons Jr., who they knew by the nickname of Ray, said, Moses, have you ever killed anybody? No. Well, I have.
Wow. The defense says the DNA evidence is not that important in this case because the defendant did construction work at the victim's home shortly before the murder. What's more important, the defense says, is the lack of witnesses.
What the state also didn't tell you about this DNA is they found DNA of other people, several other people, that they identified and said, this was this person's, this was that person's, a female, came back to some clothing or the breast of the victim in this case. They can't explain how that got there. Well, they can, but they don't like the explanation because it also explains how Mr. Coons' DNA ended there. And that is a word you're going to hear a lot about, and that word is transference. Perhaps those other people had been in that location. Perhaps they had dropped things. Perhaps they had tried on clothes at the store, and then Johanna took the clothes home, and the DNA was still on there. We don't know. But of all the people whose DNA you would expect to be in that trailer is Roy Coons Jr. You'll also hear that not only was in that trailer, there were about 90 homes in that mobile home park community, and out of those, he was in at least half of those doing maintenance work. So you would probably find his DNA in half the homes over there, not just Miss Ortega's.
The defense tried unsuccessfully to prevent the victim's text messages from coming into evidence. The judge denied that request, and the victim's mother read them to the jury through a translator.
Do you recognize the text message that you received from your daughter's device?
¿Y usted reconoce el mensaje que recibió de su
sí,
hija?
Claro.
Yes, I do, of course.
Can you read that message for the ladies and gentlemen of the jury?
¿Puede leer eso para las damas y caballeros del jurado?
Mamá, alguien está tocando la puerta.
Mom, somebody's knocking on the door.
Pubertad, se equivocó.
She wrote puberty. She made a mistake.
Puerta.
Door.
Ya se fue.
It's already gone.
Fue.
Left.
Creo que era el hombre que corta el yarda.
I think it was the man who cuts the yard.
Le respondí. Okay, no haga ruido.
And I responded, okay, don't make any noise.
The victim's mother also testified about finding her daughter's body.
Yo toqué a Joanna. Estaba fría.
I touched Joanna, and she was cold.
What part of her body did you touch?
¿Qué parte de su cuerpo tocó?
Yo toqué su brazo.
I touched her arm.
Ella estaba fría.
She was cold.
Yo sabía que le habían hecho daño.
I knew that she had been hurt.
Can you describe her clothing?
¿Puede describir su ropa?
No. Ella tenía su pantalón más abajo de lo normal.
She had her pants lower than normal.
Tenía una cinta de karate en el cuello.
She had a karate belt in her neck.
Tenía dos vueltas.
She had two rounds of it.
Tenía dos vueltas y estaba amarrada por la parte de atrás con doble nudo.
It had two rounds around the neck and it was tied in the back with a double knot.
Estaba demasiado apretada.
It was too tight.
Su cuello lucía demasiado delgado.
Her neck looked very too thin.
Ella tenía sangre en la boca.
And she had blood in her mouth.
Yo sabía que sabían hecho daño a mi nena.
I knew that someone had hurt my girl.
Le dije, Jocelyn, pásame el 911.
I told Jocelyn, give me the 911.
El 911 comenzó a darme instrucciones. Yo le quité la cinta del cuello.
911 started giving me instructions and I took the belt off her neck.
Su cuello estaba muy delgado.
Her neck was very, very thin.
Let's bring the panel into this discussion now. Linda, Bob, I can't picture something more horrible than this poor mother finding her daughter, and she's trying to find the strength to testify about it.
Right, and you know what, Aaron, when I'm watching this again for the third time, I think, this morning, and then I'm on the show, and then with you, you know, usually when you have a translator, it's very difficult, right? But heartbreak is a universal language, and you don't even need to hear her words, right? You don't need to know what they say. You saw what she felt, and by seeing what she felt, you see what she saw.
Exactly. 90% of communication, the old theory goes, is nonverbal or whatever the percentage is. I know they try to dispute it every now and then, but Bob, the big question is, who did it? And you know, it's hard to put the emotion aside, but the question is, who did it? In a case like this, I think the defense is doing the best it can to try to refute the DNA evidence. But these words and behaviors that the state talked about during the open, that might be the key evidence here.
And of course, in the days before DNA evidence, circumstantial evidence always led to convictions where there was a conviction. So all these other dots, they're trying to connect. And I think that in the end of the day, if they can't get over the hurdle of DNA, they still have these other hurdles that they have to deal with.
The behaviors here, Linda, the moving into a homeless camp,
the
statements,
right.
Yeah, the words. I mean, that's what's highly suspicious here. Even if I sit here and say, okay, you know, so if he's doing all this construction work, maintenance work, yeah, maybe the DNA is a wash. Maybe if I were on the jury, would have to discount that. But then if I start to add up the words and the behaviors, this is old-fashioned detective work, that's what might carry the day
yes,
here again.
Yes, you're absolutely right. If indeed he said to Moses, I've killed somebody, that will convince the jury. Of course, we have cases where statements have been wrong or made up. So, you know,
maybe he's trying to scare people in the homeless camp. We don't know. We're going to have to watch all that play out. Linda Kenny Bodden, Bob Hill, appreciate the insight tonight. That's all for us here on The Debrief. Our live trial coverage resumes at 9 a.m. tomorrow here on the Law & Crime Network. The Debrief will be back at 5 o'clock Eastern right here on Law & Crime. Good night.